You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's banking and capital markets tax practice. And today I'm joined by my colleague, Kelly Wooten. Kelly's a principal in KPMG's information reporting and withholding group. Welcome, Kelly.
Thanks, Liz.
Great to have you here. And today we're going to talk about, spoiler alert, information reporting. I think your group title says it all. It's been an interesting few weeks. We have the new One Big Beautiful Bill, HR1, was passed and signed into law. We're going to call that OB3 for ease going forward. In the bill, there's a lot of things that have the potential to impact banking operations. And those are really some of the information reporting changes, I think.
There were a lot of information reporting changes that were included in the bill, and I'm really excited for several of them. Some of them are items that we've asked for years, such as the change in the reporting threshold for Forms 1099 MIS and 1099 NEC. And then others were somewhat of surprises, such as the new auto loan reporting requirement.
That's right. So there's some good things, and then there's some things that may be a little bit problematic in terms of operational difficulties. But why don't we start with the auto loan reporting requirements? And we're going to go through other changes as well. But if we start with the auto loan reporting requirements, the first question I get from people when talking about this is, wait a minute, why do banks have to report this? So why don't we back up a level and set the stage that and say that as part of the bill, one of the provisions is that individual taxpayers will now be allowed to deduct certain interest expense paid on auto loans for qualifying automobiles beginning in 2025. So that is for purchases of qualified automobiles after 1/1/25, an individual has the potential to deduct that interest. Well, they will be getting a form from the banks, similar to what we get for mortgage interest reporting on 1098s and other information reporting like 1099 DIVs that we get that help us prepare our tax returns, right? So with that in mind, that's the provision. That's a good thing probably for certain individuals. But now let's flip back to the banking side, Kelly, and talk about what that means with this new requirement in a bank.
So one of the first things I always learned about information reporting was that it is the IRS tool to ensure that income is getting reported as it should and to provide support for different deductions. And this is a perfect example of that. So the required information for this new information reporting requirement is going to include the amount of interest received during the year from that individual, the outstanding principal amount on that loan balance as of the beginning of the calendar year, the origination date of the loan, the year, the make, and the model of the vehicle, and the VIN. That reporting is, like you mentioned, is going to be effective for vehicles acquired after December 31st, 2024. So that is going to include sort of the buyapalooza that we saw in advance on concerns about certain tariffs taking place that could push up the prices of vehicles. And the other interesting piece here is this is sort of a time-banded provision. That individual tax deduction is only valid through 2028 right now. And so the final version of OB3 had what's known as a conditional applicability clause. And basically, once the deduction is gone, the information reporting requirement will be gone as well.
So that's interesting. And I think there's a bunch of different things we can unpack about the requirements you just laid out. But let's start with that timing. So it's a temporary provision. We see that a lot. We saw that in TCJA. I think the feeling from the legislative standpoint is once something's in there that is a benefit to constituents, it gets maybe easier to renew, harder to take away. But that I can certainly see why it may have been put in initially as temporary. But again, back to the banks, this could be a whole lot of operational change for what maybe turns out to be truly temporary. Maybe it has a longer tail and gets extended.
Yes. So timing is going to be really interesting here. So we've got 2025 reporting that's going to be due in January of 2026. And it's terrifying to me that we're already sitting here in the middle of July. So banks should already be working to figure out how to implement this reporting requirement. And it's also important to appreciate that we're missing a few pieces of the puzzle. So we need the IRS to provide regulations. We need the IRS to provide a draft form, hopefully quickly followed by a final form. And I would think that probably is pretty likely, given that the IRS can likely leverage a good bit of that existing Form 1098 for mortgage interest. And then we also need instructions on how to complete it.
And so one question that listeners may have is, well, will this get extended? And we've seen that elsewhere in the information reporting space, right? Certain requirements around FATCA and other things where the start date for certain reporting would get pushed back. Do you think that happens here? Because I think the interesting thing here is it's not, there's a positive on the side for individuals. So it might be harder to push something out given that individuals may not want that. They may want to be able to actually take this deduction.
Yes. So I would love to have the crystal ball for that. But that will be one of the really interesting questions. I think there are a couple different options. One, let's see what kind of guidance we can get from the IRS. They may try to really expedite that and get it out. And they like to use sort of language around best effort sometimes when they know there hasn't necessarily been time for organizations to really be able to get all of their processes in order. I can definitely see them trying to do something like that just because there is a very, very little ramp up time. It's essentially through 2028. The other option is, you know, potentially the IRS could say, fine, we're not going to require reporting for this year, even though we will allow the deduction for this year. However, I think that puts a lot of pressure on individuals to be able to know that there actually is this benefit, which clearly Congress wanted to make available to them. So I think that's probably unlikely. So withholding agents, they're going to need to ramp up pretty quickly. And I think the tech spend will be interesting. So with it potentially being just through 2028, are banks and other institutions going to want to put in place the Maserati of solutions, or are they going to want to do something a bit more conservative under the premise that it may only be around for a couple of years? I think one of the options there that institutions should think of is, you know, do they figure out a way to pull that data and then potentially go an outsourcing or a managed services route versus trying to put in place a lot of the plumbing like they may do if it was a permanent reporting requirement.
Yeah, that's a great point. But let's talk about some of that required data. You listed off several things that will need to be on the form. Interest, right? So that makes sense. That comes off of loan systems typically. It may not be too hard for banks to access. But there's a lot of information about the car itself. First of all, it has to be a qualified automobile, which means final assembly happened within the United States. That's not always readily known. You also need things like the VIN number, the remaining balance on the loan, maybe make model. I don't know. Tell us again everything that's needed.
So we're going to need to know the amount of the interest received and the outstanding principal amount as of the beginning of the calendar year. So that's probably consolidated together in one system. Then they're also going to need the origination date of the loan, the year, make, and model of the vehicle, and the VIN. So chances are that may not all be included in the same lending system, or they may have certain of those data elements in the lending system, but not all of them. So for example, one of the institutions that we work with has indicated they do not electronically capture VINs. So they're looking at how quickly they can sort of go through their hard copies of titles and get those scanned in via OCR technology to be able to have that VIN information. And the VIN information, obviously it's required on the information return, But that's also important because the VIN helps indicate what is going to be a qualifying vehicle loan, because there's information in that VIN that indicates where that final assembly is taking place. So it'll be interesting. Institutions right now should go ahead and be figuring out where they're going to be able to get all of these different data elements from. So sort of that mapping and matching exercise. They're also going to need to figure out if it's multiple systems, how they're going to be able to pull that data out of each system and then aggregate it into one final form.
That's a lot to pull together in a short time between now and January to pull it together in a capacity such that you're reporting it out in some form that has not yet been created.
Yes.
That's great. I'm glad you could take us through that. Certainly for institutions making auto loans, there's a lot to consider and some implementation to do between now and year end. The good news is it looks back only as far as January 1st of this year. But I guess the bad news is there isn't time to get this process in place before you start making the loans. You may have already made some.
Yes. And sort of that look back exercise to you, if data has to be input electronically into systems where it's not currently input today. So those are items that can take a little bit of time to get up and running. So I would definitely encourage anyone at one of those institutions that is working on this, if you haven't already started speaking, maybe taking donuts into your tech team on a daily basis, this is probably the time to start doing that.
Great idea with the donut. So I think there were some welcome changes in 1099s and certain thresholds. Do you want to talk us through that, Kelly?
Absolutely. This was great news for us. It is a very welcome change, and it's a long-awaited change. So OB3 increases the threshold for Form 1099 MIS and 1099 NEC. So our miscellaneous payments like other income or gross proceeds paid to attorneys, and the NEC for non-employee compensation, it increases that threshold from $600 to $2,000 for payments that are made after December 31st of 2025.
That has been a $600 threshold since the beginning of time, I feel like.
That $600 threshold is older than I am. So it's definitely time for an increase.
Okay, so that is good news. And it's going to $2,000 and then starts getting some annual inflation index?
Yes. So there is an inflation adjustment provision that is going to annually increase that threshold thereafter.
Excellent.
The one key piece that I would flag here is that it is solely with respect to the payment types that already have a $600 threshold. So royalties, for example, are going to continue to have a $10 threshold.
Okay. So if it was a $600 threshold before, all of those increased to the $2,000. If it was other than $600, it stays where it is.
Yes, exactly.
Great. So yeah, I assume there's some practical considerations then for that reporting and what that threshold change means within the bank.
Absolutely. So this is one where if you have not spoken with your accounts payable team, you want to go ahead and do that and make sure they're aware of this upcoming change. And then also, if you think about it, so many different types of payments and giveaways. If you listen to sort of the legalese following them, it mentions that payments will be capped at $599.99 or things like that. Or giveaways have been calculated based on making sure that they fall just shy of that $600 threshold so as not to require tax reporting historically. So it'll be interesting to see what we start seeing in terms of changes around those, because that is something where they've always been focused on that $600 threshold. They haven't really had to update that language because the threshold is so old. And now all of a sudden, we're going to start seeing it be indexed for inflation as well.
That's an interesting point. Maybe certain prizes will get larger.
Yes.
Okay, Kelly, so the changes we just talked about cover the 1099 MIS and the 1099 NEC, but I think there was also some changes related to the 1099 K. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So 1099K is used for payment card reporting and third-party settlement organizations to do their reporting. And so essentially, OB3 reestablishes the original threshold of $20,000 and 200 transactions for reporting by these third-party settlement organizations. So these are the Venmos and the PayPals of the world, for example. And this change repeals the reduced de minimis threshold of $600 with no transaction minimum that was introduced under the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, or ARPA. So the interesting piece of this is that the provision is retroactive and applies to calendar years beginning after December 31st, 2021. So effectively making it as if that ARPA change never occurred. So with it applying retroactively, it's good because that could provide some relief for payers who were not able to comply with the reporting required under the lower threshold.
And can we talk for a minute about the companies or businesses that this relates to, you third-party processors? And I think from a banking perspective, that could pull in some merchant card processing, but not necessarily all banks. Is that right?
Right. So there are two types of reporting under Form 1099-K. You've got the merchant acquiring entity, which is basically someone uses their MasterCard or their Visa or their American Express card, and it's moving that funding from the account to the actual vendor that they use the card at. Those entities, there was never a threshold for reporting there, so this is not going to be relevant to them. This reporting is going to be focused solely on the third-party settlement organizations. So if I go onto a website to order a new t-shirt over the weekend and I use some PayPal, I use Venmo, I use something similar where I'm going through a platform to make that payment, those are the payments that are going to come into scope.
Okay, so that's a great clarification because I think there were some banks wondering, you know, if and how it applied to them. So one last thing in the bill that I want to spend just a minute on, Kelly, is the remittance tax. In the House version, there was a pretty onerous tax that I think would have had a much larger impact on financial institutions. In the final legislation, there's still the remittance tax, although less impact to our banks. Can you talk us through that?
OB3 added a new 1% remittance tax on an electronic transfer of funds initiated by a remittance transfer provider when that remittance is requested by an individual located in the United States and paid to a recipient who's located outside the United States. Originally, pretty much anyone who was making these types of payments for an individual, they were going to be in scope. However, the final bill includes a really notable exemption that if the remittance is made either via a U.S. debit or credit card, or an account held at a bank that is insured by the FDIC or a bank covered by the Bank Secrecy Act, then those payments are going to be out of scope. So yes, this was very concerning when it originally came out because of the very broad nature of what was going to be included. However, with these scope changes, it's primarily going to be focused on the money movers.
Great. So I agree. Really welcome news in the carve-outs in the final version that I think covered the consternation we were seeing with the earlier version.
And perhaps the most welcome news of all was that Section 899, or the revenge tax, was completely eliminated from the legislation. That would have been very challenging for banks to implement. So I know that everybody was breathing a very big sigh of relief when those provisions were removed based on some agreements that were obtained with some foreign governments.
Yes, I totally agree. Some of the 899 provisions would have been really difficult, if not what seemed like impossible from the information reporting perspective and bank operations. So glad to see that that was not in the final. So Kelly, if we think about operations, is this a good time to look at policies, procedures, get things in shape or change? What are your thoughts around that?
Absolutely. It's always a good time to look at policies and procedures, but especially at a time like this when there have been significant regulatory changes. This is actually a very hot topic for the IRS right now. Policies and procedures are, that is one of the key items that the IRS always asks as one of the first document requests on an audit. They want to see that policy and procedure document. They want to talk to the people that are involved in those processes, and they want to make sure that it's a living document that people are actually following versus something that just sort of is sitting on some type of shared drive that may or may not ever get accessed once it's signed off on. So definitely a good time to go look at those documents. Also, this is a perfect time of year to go ahead and think about training. We're getting ready to go into the final prep for the 2025 reporting that'll be due starting January of 2026. If you've got non-US persons with accounts, you're getting ready to do solicitations of updated forms W-8 for them. This is a great opportunity to do some training for your organization to cover some of these changes, but also just make sure that everybody is on top of the requirements as they exist today, that any new personnel have been adequately trained on the policies and procedures, and that everybody has a chance to sort of think about leading practices and what can be updated to ensure that your organization is compliant.
That is all great advice. Good time to take a look, review, great time for training. And Kelly, you've got some alert services. Like, I think this is a lot to keep track of. Can you tell us about a good way to keep our arms around all that?
Sure. So we do have a subscription service known as our Federal Information Reporting Practice, or IRP, alert service. That is a series of newsletters that they capture everything from highlights where the IRS has spoken at different conferences and things that they have covered, to updated forms being released. So for example, when new forms like the one that we'll be using for the auto loan interest reporting get released, there are updates about that, along with our observations when instructions or updated instructions get released, we do the same. We also do sort of annual reminders of here are all of the deadlines to consider as you start preparing for the next year. So those are always a good way to keep on top of all of the different changes that are coming down the road, as well as when the IRS releases new information out there that they expect everybody to be aware of.
Excellent. And so that's for federal changes and for state?
Yes. So there are two separate services. One is the federal service, and then we also have the state service as well, which that one is a weekly newsletter of all of the state 1099 and 1042S reporting changes, which it's always shocking to me exactly how many changes there are on a week-to-week basis. But it also includes a series of tables of all of the different types of information returns from the 1099C and the 1099A and 1099DIV and the MIS and the NEC. And it will eventually include the 1099DA that we have coming down the road for digital assets. But it includes tables that have all of the reporting and withholding requirements by state for each of those types of forms.
Very handy. This is a lot to keep track of. So that sounds like a good idea as well. So Kelly, I want to thank you for all of this information. Learned a ton today, and appreciate you being on and look forward to having you back as more information reporting changes come up.
Sounds great. Thank you for having me.
And to our audience, thank you for listening. This is Liz Lamadue on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.